Which is a more likely reunion, Vinny? Mauricio Pochettino and Tottenham or Vinny Perth and Dundalk?
There was the setup. I see it.
OTB AM. Weekdays from 7:30 AM. Listen on the OTB Sports app. The OTB Podcast Network with Getset Go. Quick Start Car Insurance that's ready when you are. Sort your policy anytime online at getsetgo.ie.
The Football Show on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power. The greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
I'm prepared to anything I can. Well, to
do it then.
Again.
Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should there be an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Then you're welcome along. So Tim Vickery will join us before we're done this evening. The Copa America at one stage did have two host countries. It's down to zero host countries. Brazil, it seems, are stepping into the breach. Plus, Aguero has reunited with Lionel Messi. So Tim Vickery is on the way. First, there is the small matter of the Champions League to discuss with Pat Nevin.
Hello, how are you doing? You well?
Very well. We had, you will like this, you will like this. We had the great Irish author Roddy Doyle on the programme earlier. He has been a Chelsea fan for a very, very long time, and we were chewing the fat about his love of Chelsea and all that. And obviously, books are a big part of his life. Happens to be reading a book by a certain Pat Nevin as we speak and is enjoying it thoroughly, and he brought that up. So Roddy Doyle is checking out your work. No pressure there, son.
Jeez, Roddy. That's a weird thing to have an author and a fabulous, fabulous author writing this stuff. I knew Roddy was a Chelsea fan. Was aware of that. But that's rather good news. But the fact is, he's actually quite enjoying it as well.
I know. He said thoroughly enjoying it. Thoroughly enjoying it. So you got to mention, you got a plug there from Roddy Doyle. So listen, hey, what about that in Porto? First of all, what was it like? I mean, I thought it looked really good on TV. The atmosphere, the whole occasion. I thought the match was very entertaining in many ways. You were doing it for Five Live, were you?
No, I was doing it for Chelsea TV. I did a lot of work for the BBC while I was over there in Porto. But it's when you end up at a Champions League final, everybody wants a bet. Actually, I was on News Talk in the morning. You do a lot of work for a variety of people. But it's just because with less journalists there than normal, less fans there than normal, you know, you basically try to fill holes as much as possible. And it was fantastic. There was a lovely feel about the place. UEFA got in the way a wee bit, but apart from that, as UEFA tend to do, but everything else was really well organised. As you said, the stadium, I've been to the Dragao 4 or 5 times now, and it is a brilliant stadium in the summer, but not in the winter, because in the winter, it's got big bits at the end, and they're all open, so you just have rain and the wind comes in, but it looks beautiful. So everything was set up to be a great game. Certainly thought Man City were the favourites to win the game until I saw the lineups and thought, what are you doing, Pep? Now, we had this discussion, didn't we, last week about Pep overthinking, and it's the weakness. And apparently everyone's talking about it all the time now. But he does. He overthinks it. And he did another thing. I don't know if, obviously, you watched it on TV, and I don't know how much was said on TV or how it was described, their system. But honestly, it was so hard to tell what on earth they were thinking. Zinchenko, I don't know to this day what position he was playing. I've no idea. It certainly wasn't left back, and it certainly wasn't left wing back. It was somewhere just off inside left. And you're thinking, why are you doing that, which makes the two, three centre, three left, one far left, one far right, one in the middle. It's like Chelsea would love you to play that way, and you've just played that way. And that's, and then, by the way, on top of that, we'll not play a defensive midfielder. And you're looking at it and you're going, oh my goodness. I mean, well done, Pep, for going for it and putting all those attack-minded players in. But absolutely, 10 out of 10 for Steyl, minus several million for good thinking. It really was a bad tactical day for Pep. But Chelsea played well, and just about every player on their team played well. It was a pretty, you know, the weather was great, the lovely feeling of 14,000, which sounded great. And do you know the best thing about it is, you would notice it, you go in and it looks full, because you've got light blue Man City and the dark blue Chelsea fans, but the seats are blue. So it looks as if the whole place is just full. And it was a real lovely buzz to the thing. And I thought right from start, I agree with yourself, from the start of the game, There was chances. It was open. It was end to end. And the biggest shock is that, you know, it only ended up 1-0. I suppose that's no shock for Chelsea because that's their stock score under Thomas Tuchel. But there were so many bits of great skill in the game and interesting things in the game that were going on, some of which I couldn't quite understand. Pep kept on making these changes. Yeah. And I was looking at him and thinking, I don't know what you're doing. And then at half-time, these players were walking out. If you ever get a chance to watch this, watch it again. These players were walking out for half-time. They're all talking to each other as if to say, do you know what's going on? Do you know where you're supposed to be? Honestly, it was a really, really weird setup. But in the end, you know, Chelsea played incredibly well and, you know, a lot of very, very top performances. I mean, as I've explained in this show before, N'Golo Kante lives slightly in the future. He knows exactly what everyone's going to do before they do it. It's weird. It is really weird. But I've kind of talked a lot about Havertz in the past, about how I think he could be one of these special players in world football.
Yeah.
You're beginning to see it a bit now. He's just so stupidly elegant. And lots of things that were good about
him. I hadn't realised, Roddy Doyle mentioned it earlier, that Kante's nickname is the Twins, which is great.
I know. It was a great quote many years ago. Who was the player he played with alongside the Englishman he played with at Leicester? He went to Chelsea with him. I can't remember his name though. He got that few games for him. There's people shouting at the radio now. Anyway, completely gone. I'll come back in a minute.
I'll Google him. That's annoying me. He was yet another in a long line of Scott Parker types who you thought would do well, but never got a game.
Anyway, so the story is, so them two were the two sitting midfielders, and then you had three in front of them and one up front. And people always used to say, so which side does Kante play on? Both. That was the whole point. Yeah, two, but he was actually both sides. And he was absolutely extraordinary in the game. And there's a lot of people afterwards calling for Ballon d'Ors for him. Now, if Kante had played that way for the entire season, as opposed to most of it, I think Ballon d'Or would be a particularly acceptable concept because he is an amazing footballer.
Danny Drinkwater, by the way, of course.
That's the one.
12 appearances for Chelsea.
It didn't make much of an impact, as we said. It was the pure quality they needed was so far above his standard. But, you know, he had a great time with him and Kante with Leicester, so you can never take that away from him. But
I'm so glad you mentioned Zinchenko. So we'll get into the Rodri Fernandinho thing and the extent to which it had a bearing on the match in a moment. But the TV offering here, and it's rarely the case, but because it was such a big game, the TV offering here gave you a tactical cam, which is just the wide version, all 22 players at all times, view of the pitch. And I thought to myself, wow, I am so on for this. This is how I'm watching the game. And I only lasted about 12 minutes. There was no commentary, which actually after a while just kind of got in on me. And you couldn't see, it was so far away. We're not quite there yet, I think, with this tactical cam. You couldn't see the minutiae of what was going on. I felt like I was missing too much of the game, so I flicked over. But one of the other things which was really bothering me, and I wanted to go over to the commentary team to see if they were explaining it, was Zinchenko. So, you know, very quickly I could see what the Chelsea shape was and where everyone was and what they were doing. And I was looking at Zinchenko in midfield and I really felt I need someone to explain this to me. I don't know, I can see what he's doing. I can see he's standing there in midfield, but I don't know what's the purpose or what's the thinking or... And I felt I was really missing the commentary to break it down for me. So now you come along, relieved to say, and say you weren't too sure either. So that's kind of a relief. It was incredibly eye-catching where he was.
It was. It just seemed wrong. If it wouldn't have been the case, but if you were looking at it completely as a watcher who's never seen a team before, you would think, you don't know where to play. You don't know your position. You're standing in the wrong place. Now, that cannot happen at that level of football, and it didn't happen. That's not what it was. But it was that odd. And I was thinking, I really did try and think about it, because then I started going on, you get the tactical sort of heat maps and things like that when you're watching games at stadiums and UEFA games particularly. You can flick the channels and you get the average positions maps. And Chelsea's, at the end of the game, was as if it was just starting. It was like as if they were setting up to start the game. It was exactly the right positions, all players exactly where they should be. That was their average position. And whereas Man City's, you were looking at it and you think, no, it's just a mess. It's just a kind of weird blob with people in the wrong bits. But it was maybe, and it's just a maybe, and I thought of this at the time, moves Zinchenko a wee bit further in, drags Havertz or whoever's playing in the right back into that midfield to cover him, because Zinchenko could go forward, which allows you to push Foden up and centre forward alongside De Bruyne. Mm. It's nonsense, but it was the only thing that was happening, right? But I was watching it, I was thinking, so I've got, I'm not hiding, I had the Chelsea bias, I prefer Chelsea to win, although you know what yourself, I love Man City and I love what they do and I love what Pep does. But I was thinking, I'm playing against them and they're playing their best midfielder who, with running with the ball and see things in front of him up front with his back to the goal. And I'm thinking, why are you doing that? Mm. And it wasn't, De Bruyne wasn't coming off at all. And his intelligence is, can beat most people, but he's up against Thiago Silva, who's as intelligent a player in the other way.
Yeah.
And then at one point, 20, 25 minutes into it, he's shouting and bawling at Foden, going, get up there beside him. So your two strikers were Foden and Zinchenko up against centre-backs. And you're thinking, that's not what they're good at. Yeah. they're all right at it, but that's not what they're good at. Yeah. They're good at facing the other way and running that way. And you've taken them out of the play. And it was very, very odd and counterintuitive. And the most intuitive thing about it is he wants lots of attackers. He wants to make it an open game. It's this total football idea, etc. But you need a base to it. And the base was so shaky. I mean, Werner had his shooting boots on, which he will one day. He could have had two or three. The chances, they were so wide open. And the goal is a classic example of it. And we're not being clever after the event. I don't tweet very much, but before the game, I'm actually asking that question. I tweeted it, you know, is this genius? Or has he overthought it again? He's overthought it again. And it was really messy. And I felt quite sorry because it was 25 minutes in the game. You're thinking, it's not quite Chelsea, we've got this, but it's Chelsea, right, okay, then we're not second best here. There's every chance Chelsea can win this game. But there's times you play against City and it's not like that. And it, who knows, it might have been exactly the same because Chelsea played well. But I don't know. The goal was a classic, because if you look at the goal, have a little freeze frame of the goal. We'll see it a million times from here on in. But it's a massive big gap through the middle that Havertz runs into. Who's the closest player to him? Well, it's a guy that should have actually been back there marking him. It's Zinchenko, who's 40 yards away from him originally, in his wrong place. But this, I think it's because he's told to be in the wrong place. And that thing I was explaining to you about the three defenders, and one's way over there in the left back, one's way over there in the right back, and one's central. There's a massive amount of gaps. And what are you playing against? Two lightning quick players like Werner and Havertz. And there's the other side of it where Chelsea had to defend really well on a couple of occasions. Sure. And Rudiger had a brilliant one tackle. There was one great tackle actually from Ben Chilwell. There was one moment where Azpilicueta had to put a ball with his left foot over the bar from 4 yards. And that was either brilliant or lucky. I don't know yet.
it took a reasonable bounce for him that he could get under it a touch, but it was hold your breath moment, yeah. Funny on Zinchenko for the goal, and I take your point about his wider positioning. I did feel like, speaking from memory, he was pretty much shoulder to shoulder, if not even slightly goal side of Havertz originally in that move. I thought that was just right beside him,
should be inside him.
Okay, yeah, but I still thought, oh, be alive to the danger. You're not in such a ridiculously awful position that you shouldn't be able to keep pace with him and get a foot in somewhere. I just thought that was good old fashioned bad defending on his part as opposed to Pep's fault.
Both, I would imagine, at that point in time. But you're asking him to play those two positions. You can't actually do this to them at the same time. And Havertz is intelligent. I mean, super intelligent.
Yeah.
Didn't speak brilliantly after the game. Although he did really speak brilliantly. It's exactly what we all felt, you know, as people, as fans. If you're a fan of the team, that's the right answer, even with the expletives. I mean, in Ireland, am I right in thinking this? I can remember doing a show with John Giles for yourselves, and John swore right at the start.
Yeah,
it was live radio.
Yeah.
Honestly, the BBC would shut down.
I know.
Whereas
We're not as bad.
I know, you just went, fair enough.
John Giles can say what he wants. That's also in the Constitution. When you talk about De Bruyne there, you know, hovering in the most crowded area of the pitch and doing nothing and never kind of even dropping deep at any stage or just asking different questions. And Foden, you know, playing in this deeper role where you're asking your 21-year-old genius to try and do it in a position he's not as used to. And then the other thing, I mean, it was a complete systems failure, I guess, from Pep's point of view, in that he's dealing with all those problems, and there's quite a few problems there. And he's also got Reece James getting the better of Sterling in a good old-fashioned one-on-one, and you've got Chilwell getting the better of Mahrez in a good old-fashioned one-on-one. So even, like, he didn't have those individuals to dig him out of his tactical hole that he'd managed to dig himself. Like, so kind of everything that could go wrong did go wrong, really.
Yeah, and there was, quite often we say, somebody will do something brilliant.
Yeah.
But Tuchel had kind of outthought him in a few ways, really, and they kind of, you know, the ugly stuff that Jorginho did, the ugly stuff that Mount did, the ugly stuff that Kante always did, they did it brilliantly. There was a moment, I think it was 20 minutes in or something, it was around about that, where eventually De Bruyne actually got the better of, I think it was Chilwell, and turned to go inside, and it was 20 yards out on the right-hand side. And now he's in major, perfect De Bruyne territory. And then he's tackled by Mount. Mm. But at the game, I could see where Mount had come from, and it was jaw-dropping. He spotted it from about 60 yards away.
Right.
And he had given that full pelt, I know what's going on here. And eventually when he gets by him, Mount's in there. And Mount, that was Kante-esque. So you had Jorginho doing that, you had Kante doing that, and he was doing that. Rudiger was defending like a monster. So on top of that, you're right, every Chelsea player had a really good game. One or two people said to me that Jorginho was quieter. To some degree, yeah, but he did all the ugly stuff.
Yes.
Actually, I was talking to Jorginho before the game. I had to do the flash interviews before the game. And apart from the first question, which made him laugh, he was so calm about it. He was so direct about it. He was so happy and relaxed about it. That was the thing that got me, the happiness and the relaxation about it. And I know that he gets nervy because, you know, when he came to the club, he never looks nervy on the pitch, but it meant so much to me. He was crying at the end. But he had himself in a fabulous, fabulous place. And everywhere I went around, by the way, the first question, because I'd never met him before, my first question was, can you understand Billy Gilmore? And he went, ah, I understand. You speak slowly.
Yeah.
And then from then on, and he's just laughing and having a joke.
And do you think this is, because it can feel a bit simplistic to hone in on the Fernandinho Rodri thing and 59 of 60 games, one of them has played, etc. But do you think if Fernandinho does play and Sterling comes out and Foden moves further up the pitch and suddenly, you know, the patterns that they're all very familiar with take hold again, is it an entirely different game, or does Tuchel's plan still prove very difficult for them?
I wouldn't be surprised at 0-0.
Yeah.
And maybe even penalties.
Yeah. Okay.
That's what I wouldn't be. And then you're on lottery time at that point in time. But I think it's cost him a goal. I'm not sure Chelsea playing the way they had played, they would have been broken down, because they were defending that fabulously well. And I heard another stat that after the goal, neither team got a shot on target.
Yeah.
So I'm saying 0-0. Isn't that big a deal to say 0-0, because that's kind of the way it was. Now, wasn't it a boring 0-0 game? It's very interesting because the technical side of it was fabulous and the skill side of it was really quite special with some of the players. But they were mostly in dark blue in that game. But I think Pep would take that now. But on the other side, that's Pep. He wants to win attacking, win playing beautiful football, all that stuff. He's learned a wee bit of pragmatism over the last year or two. But pragmatism went out the window for that one. And
yeah,
cost.
It does illustrate, and like, this is not to have a reductive, is he a bad manager, is he a good manager, it's all black and white conversation, but it does illustrate a weakness on his part, because this is now a trend of a certain neuroticism taking hold at the really crunch moments over the last number of years. I mean, there was one for Munich against Real Madrid where he was too clever by half. He himself mentioned Leon in the press conference. It was, you know, front of his mind, where he was asked, why did you not play Fernandinho? And he said, look, it's the same with the Leon game. It's the same with this game. I do my best. So it's interesting. Even he knew it was in the same category. There is something there that for all the analysis he's doing of each kind of micro moment, he's not taking a step back and almost saying to himself, I have a tendency here at these moments to try and come up with something a bit clever. And actually, even though I still want to do that this time around, I'm going to resist it because it's not serving me well. And it doesn't seem like there's anybody around him who can say, Pep, you're doing that thing again.
You know, because it's not one thing. It's not one set of, I think that, then I'll think that, so I'll do C.
Yeah.
He's down his Z at this point in time. He's forgot where he is. he's gone that far. I've seen managers doing it. I've seen lots of managers doing it. And they end up, they'll pick a team and they've left their best player out. And you're thinking, what have you done that for?
Yeah.
If you started from get them guys in there and then work a system around that. And I've watched managers do it. They've just overthought it to a point of view of, oh, you know, they don't remember the original. And it's not, he's not a bad manager. He's a wonderful manager. He's still probably the best in many ways in a vast majority of the areas. But the other side of it, and I absolutely get this, how many cup finals has he lost? I think it might only be a couple. So when he gets there, the real big ones, but it's the one before it, sometimes it's been causing them, you know, quarters or semis.
Leon was quarters, yeah.
Exactly. But this time he's done it in a final. Because and that's bad.
Even if there's like merit to the plan, the change is born of nervousness on his part and his players recognise that. And so, I mean, that was what I was thinking when you were talking about Jorginho. Because you look at Chelsea, there was clarity all over that pitch. There was absolute clarity. Like the Pep's nervousness must be contagious. Everybody must be on edge going, God, do we need to do something beyond the norm here to win this match? And actually you don't. It's just a football match.
If you're a new manager and everything's going really, really well, you just blindly trust, oh, he must have a bigger plan than the rest of us. If you've been under a manager for a long time and you know that there are one or two foibles, you recognise them as a group. And it kind of almost needs somebody within the group to say, look, come on, I don't think we're that confident about that. But that's a tough thing to do in the Champions League final.
Yeah.
It really is a big call, because even as a player or another coach, you're thinking, yeah, but he is the best, he's the business, he must know what he's doing, he's seen some weakness there in Chelsea or the opposition, so that would stop you doing it. It's something I've watched in managers, and you bang your head against the wall and think sometimes, and I'm not saying it happened with Pep there, but sometimes the team are saying, We know better here, actually. I've played with teams where we've basically ignored the manager and done our own thing. And it's happened more than one club I was at. But certainly I've known managers where they'll do it and they'll say it, and we'll all just look at each other and think, he's missed it. He's absolutely missed the point. Sometimes it's something very specific. The most common one is they are just too cagey, they are just too defensive, they are just too fearful. They're thinking about the opposition too much. And it's the most classic one that I know, that you've sat and worried about what the dangers are and forgot about what you've got. Mm. And did Thomas Tuchel change at all for Pep Guardiola? I don't think he did. I think Thomas Tuchel played Thomas Tuchel's best side. But I don't think Pep did. I think he looked at what was in the opposition and thought, well, if I have the ball for 80% of the game, then they can't damage us. Thing is, Chelsea are pretty good at keeping the ball as well. They're all right at it. Yeah. And if they don't, hell of a good at defending as well. So, yeah, I mean, if he had it again, maybe Pep would do something completely different. And maybe you have to go through a wee bit of pain first. You know, to win that Champions League, you sometimes have to go a wee bit of pain. You know, Chelsea lost it against Manchester United, didn't they? Before they finally got their one against Bayern. Mm. And again, if you played the game tonight and changed that a wee bit, you have a different result. That's how close the teams were in the end.
Yeah, I was kind of it's just a ludicrous moment where Thomas Tuchel is meeting Abramovich for the first time at this match for various reasons. The texters are on to me here about a few things. So, yes, Adrian, are you going to ask Pat about Roddy's favourite player or what? Yes, I am. So I, to my eternal shame here, it seems. So Brian, for instance, said, as punishment for your admission, this is in the conversation with Roddy earlier, of having little or no prior knowledge of Charlie Cook, I sentence you to admitting this lapse to Pat Nevin on air. I'm interested to hear Pat's response. Great interview with Roddy Doyle, says Brian. So there I am admitting to you, Charlie Cook. I mean, I'm au fait with Chopper Harris and a few of the boys, obviously, but Charlie Cook had passed me by. Scottish winger, I'm told. Is this an egregious error on my part, or is Roddy's choice of Charlie Cook as favourite Chelsea player ever a little bit niche?
It's not niche.
Right. this is just a shocker on my part, is it?
No, it's an age thing. It's just
I feel like if you were to mention quite a few of the Chelsea boys from 60s, 70s, they'd ring bells. I just haven't heard much about Charlie Cook.
Charlie was a fabulous player. I've seen certain amounts of him. again, a player who would be more suited to the game today, far more suited to the game today. He wasn't a tricky winger. He was a very skillful player who could play midfield to wing, to attack, creative. It slightly drove me mad because the day I arrived, everyone said the same thing. So you're the new Charlie Cook, then? And I got it from the day I arrived because he's Scottish. He's come down from a smaller club. And I got it. And I got it for years. Years and years and years. And I'll tell you to this day, I still get it. You're my favourite player apart from, and it's either Charlie Cook or Zola or Hazard. It's always them. It's always them. I get it all the time. Now, a lot of people used to say this direct link. The Chelsea fans will say that it kind of starts with Cookie, right? So it's Charlie, and then there's been others, but they often mention my name kindly, yes, although I'm not in that class. And then they'd say Zola, and then but then they used to say Mata, and then Hazard. And it was kind of, you can see that they're kind of all quite small players, very technical players, and Chelsea fans, there are big sets of Chelsea fans. That was their type of player, the type that they absolutely loved. But Kuki did this, tell me a story about Kuki. I've met him. It's funny when someone says that to you, that you're the new or you're that person. Didn't meet him for 20 years after that. Never met him. And I'd heard so much about him, and but never met him because he'd gone away to live in America. And I'd read about him and I knew what he was doing. And then he just turned up one day at the club and we bumped into each other. It was just smiling of knowing each other, though we didn't. We'd never met. This lovely smile. And my first question I asked him, and it was about the coaching he was doing. And he was doing that version of the Dutch coaching, and he was taking it over all over America. And it was just so perfect for him. And he made a fortune out of it, I believe. And he's a bit well loved over there. And he played in America near the end of his career as well. But as I'm like a lot of people, had limited the amount of time that I've seen him. I've seen all the footage there is of him basically now with my time working at Chelsea. But Cookie would have been, he'd have been the Silva type and all that. So taller than Silva, more direct than him, David Silva. But he was that type of player and kind of unusual for his time.
Right.
And by the way, what a tash.
I just Googled it there. Yeah. No, I hear you. I'm hearing you were at the players' after party on Saturday, were you?
I was. And
give us the goss. What's the players' party like in 2021?
A lot more sober than it was when I used to play.
I'd say so, yeah. They're all just sitting around, are they?
No, they weren't all just sitting around. Absolutely not. I'd actually just come back to the hotel and they sent a car and said, look, get down to the They've got the players are all there. Some waves. Roman was there, the manager, obviously. And I'm actually not that into that sort of stuff, really. But I said, look, I'll leave it. But there was two other people there, the producer and the commentator. And they said, it'll look bad, mate. You've got to go. All right. This is like 2 a.m. at this point in time. And I'm doing radio the next morning at 9. So, all right, I'll go for an hour. So I went down. You can always see the rest coming. So I went down there and honestly, it was like walking into a Bond movie. You know, you see those Bond sets. It's like an entire beautiful, it's basically used to be a warehouse, but ain't a warehouse tonight. It's absolutely phenomenal amount of money put in this. I mean, had they lost, were City going to use it? I don't know. And it was on the riverfront and there's all sorts of checks to get past and get in and there's all sorts of limos and all that sort of stuff. And got in there and by that time they'd all had a few and some of them had maybe gone as well, but just strange things started happening. And then they're throwing the cup to each other and things like that. And you're sitting there in the European Cups there. I leant against the table once, nearly knocked the thing down. It was cobbled stone. I just spattered the thing. And they're all just gone for it. And it was just nice to kind of almost kind of watch it a little bit. There's one lovely moment. I was talking to wee Billy Gilmore, and Billy and I kind of know each other a bit now.
Yeah.
And it had a few. It definitely had a few. He's got a backpack. You have a selfie with me, and I'm going, it's probably the other way around, but yeah, right. And he's giving it, and as we're doing it, Petr Cech walks over and he catches my eye and he goes, "Hi, Pat." And I went, "All right." And I went to see him. Billy goes, "Wait a minute, Pierre." Just palms them off because we're having a selfie. I think that's not supposed to
happen. Tell me Billy Gilmore is going to make it at Chelsea.
Oh yeah, no, he's brilliant.
He will, brilliant. Yeah, he's so good.
It certainly will be, I think, by the end of next season.
Okay.
He'll be in, and he'll be first pick. He's that good. Yeah. It might be even quite early next season, so he's fine. One of the other moments was with some of the people who work at Chelsea have been there since I played there, which is a really unusual thing.
Mm.
And one of the girls, Jane, she said, "Oh, come and meet Thomas." And I went, "Oh, it's okay." And she said, "No, he'll be busy." "No, no." Anyway, she drags Thomas to call over to meet me. The guy's sitting with a European Cup or Champions League. And he comes over and he is honestly the loveliest man in the world. And he's sitting there and his kids are falling asleep in his lap and his wife's there and they're up. But you can tell they're knackered. They want to go home. And we have this really lovely chat about the game and the Chelsea fans and what it was like and what he's learning about it. And then I said, "Do you know what, Thomas? We're now getting about 4 a.m. I said, "Thomas, you could leave, you know, if you wanted. I know you're new here, but, you know, your family are knackered." Anyway, about 5 minutes later, he left. And I thought, yeah, sensible guy. Half an hour later, he's back again without family.
Wow, good on him.
And yeah, because he had to do it. It's a special, special, fantastic day. And just, it was lovely. Anyway, I get back home. Lots of other things. I've met lots of other players, etc., and chatted. But I got back in, and I probably had an hour's sleep. And I was woken up by the phone. And it was radio, it was World Service. No, it was BBC News. "Can you do an interview, Pat?" I sounded like Barry White. It's like, "At when?" "Now." Honestly. I'd had one or two.
Yeah.
And honestly, if you ever get that, I never want to hear
it. We might dig it out. I think that could be worked into a little montage at the top with your music, maybe. God, that's so cool to get to hang out with them all. Who's a good person to get talking to in that Chelsea team for 5 minutes?
Anytime I've spoken to just about any of them, it's been cool.
Right.
They've been really nice. I quite like to have spoken to Havertz, but he was busy and left my line quite early. Mm. And I wasn't walking about trying to talk to people.
Yeah, sure.
I'm not like that. If you happen to come into the vicinity of somebody or they come over and talk to you, it's absolutely fine. I was quite happy just to watch from a distance. And I had other people at the club that I know at the club that are various parts of the club I was enjoying talking to. So not really into muscling into those situations. But when you meet someone like Jorginho, is just an absolute sweetie. Kante is just hilarious. He's just honestly the funniest ever.
Really?
There was a great story. Do you know what? No, but undeliberately.
Okay.
Because there's a story once, and this sums up Conte, and it's the first time I'd ever heard this story about him. And I'm stopping if I've told you before, but it was exactly the same at the party. So they used to get this thing with Chelsea a few years back. They get all the team in the huddle before the game, and they take it in turns. The leader was David Luiz, and would say, "Right, turn to make the speech today is," and you would say to somebody and they would say a few words. Went to Kante once, "And Golo, your turn." Fantastic words in Golo. He couldn't speak and he was just too shy and down, couldn't go away. He won't say anything at all. He just sit there and smile like that. He said, "I actually think him and Roman Abramovich are related. They're exactly the same.
Won't say boo.
You can't see anything. Just down, eyes down, can't see anything." So there's lots of different characters there, and they're not the characters you always think they are from a distance, and they never are. And why should they be? Because we form a characterization of people from what we see from a distance, and then you get to know them, and they're vastly more kind of normal blokes with the same weaknesses and strengths as everybody else. Anything particularly worse than that, I'm afraid I can't tell you.
Yeah, no doubt. Listen, great stuff. Thanks so much.
Absolute pleasure. Just kind of one last line before I go. So the best line's been said to me this week, right? So I get to go over there. I get to go to Porto. I get to see my team, Chelsea, winning the Champions League. I go to that party. I get home, open the paper. My book's in the top 10 of the non-fiction list in the Sunday Times, right? And somebody sent me a text and said, "If Carlene made weekends, this is what it'd be like." So I've had the perfect weekend. Nice. And I couldn't be happier.
Okay, very good. Well, listen, put the feet up.
I will do.
Thanks very much. Pat Nevin with us. We're talking to Tim Vickery next.
Paddy Power as much a part of Irish football as hoofing it up to Johnny Walters.
Now, you're very welcome back. So always great to have Tim Vickery with us. Hi, Tim.
John Malloy, how are you?
Yeah, very well, very well. So yes, a few bits going on in your neck of the woods. To lose one tournament host country is unfortunate and all that. To lose two, careless. So the Copa America, I mean, this is all very condensed. I think there's World Cup qualifiers happening before it, but they're determined to play this Copa America. It seems Argentina and Colombia have bowed out and Brazil are stepping into the breach. So put some more meat in that bone. What's happening here?
Yeah, it was always an insane Copa America right from the start. It was an extra one, ironically enough, shoehorned in to take advantage of a switch from odd years to even years. And this was supposed to happen last year. And because it was an extra one, they didn't have to obey the prearranged schedule. So it's up for grabs. Who wants it? Argentina wanted it very badly. They wanted to wipe the slate clean after not being able to hold that River Plate versus Boca Juniors Libertadores final that went to Madrid. Especially important for them to do so, given the fact that Argentina is the leading partner in South America's 2030 World Cup bid, back to Uruguay, where it started in 1930 with Argentina as a senior partner. So Argentina wanted it. That enraged Colombia, who firstly were stepping aside anyway to allow this 2030 World Cup bid, because Colombia really are the next in line in terms of South America's World Cup bids. And also, they've only had one Copa in 2001 and Argentina had it in 2011. Mm. So they wanted it as well. So what do? Well, you host it between the two countries at opposite ends of a giant continent. It was always madness. Mm. It meant that instead of three groups of four, we had two groups of six. Two groups of six. Yeah. So the entire group phase to eliminate just two teams and then have eight quarterfinalists became even more ludicrous when the two invited sides, because the Copa America has had 10 South Americans plus two invited ones, the invited ones this time were Australia and Qatar. They were forced to pull out when World Cup qualifying in Asia was rescheduled for June. Mm. So suddenly you've got two groups of five and a group phase eliminating precisely one team. So the whole thing was ludicrous right from the start, and it's become more ludicrous as time has moved on. And I speak of someone who loves the Copa America. I've been to the last eight of them. Mm. Well, they were determined that it was going to happen in Colombia and Argentina. And CONMEBOL are determined it's going to happen. CONMEBOL are South America's UEFA equivalent, because they want that cash. They need the cash. You know, it's a big money spinner for them. All the contracts have been signed and so on. They had a bad year last year. They really, really don't want to rip up the contracts and have to give the money back. So they were adamant that it was going to go ahead in Colombia and in Argentina. Colombia, the wave of social unrest got worse when they tried to insist on staging games in the Copa Libertadores, South America's Champions League in Colombia. Such wonderful rallying posts if you want to protest. You've got an international match of football to protest around. So by trying to prove that Colombia could stage the cup, they ended up proving exactly the opposite. We had a game there that was interrupted five times in the first half for tear gas coming onto the field as a result of clashes between the police and protesters outside. So Colombia was then forced out, leaving Argentina. But Argentina, as it just goes into its quite nasty winter, it's like walking in a fridge in Argentina this time of year. Mm. Argentina is going through its worst moment with COVID. We've seen just over the last few days, you've seen public opinion in Argentina really swing behind the idea of not having this tournament. So on Sunday came the news that Argentina wasn't going to do it, which left CONMEBOL desperate. You know, they really want this, for want of a better term, it's one of the curses of the modern world, they really want this content. Mm. Where could they provide it? And really there was only one place that in the pre-established time zone of these games could do it all, and could do it at such short notice. Step forward, Jair Bolsonaro's Brazil.
Mm. Well, I guess it's a solution, and they'll be able to do it relatively smoothly, I would think. There's no need for this nonsense of the five group team to get rid of one, ironically, now, if it's all in the one country. I don't suppose they're going to reverse the format.
There isn't time to reverse the format. Yeah. So it's going to be that anyway.
Okay.
Assuming that it goes ahead, and I very much suspect it will, but there's a lot of outrage in Brazil about this. One politician has talked about taking this matter to the Supreme Court to try and get the thing stopped. One state governor, Pernambuco, has said games will not be allowed to take place in his state. So that there's a negative reaction against this. In terms of, I think strictly speaking, in terms of health, it is more dangerous that domestic Brazilian football is continuing than staging a Copa America. That's because, and we've already seen this in recent times, you know, players who are playing domestic games, they leave their teams. Some of them have active social lives. A couple of them have been caught in compromising situations. And obviously this helps to spread the virus. Mm. With the Copa America, they will be in a kind of bubble. And there'll be less opportunity for contact with the outside world. And there are clearly risks. We could certainly argue that they were unnecessary risks. I would probably argue that this is an unnecessary Copa America, even before the pandemic takes hold. Mm. But in strict health terms, I think the Copa America is not as dangerous as the continuation of domestic Brazilian football. But on a symbolic level, you know, in a country where the death toll is over 462,000, rising at nearly 2,000 a day, we will surely reach the 500,000 mark during this Copa America. This does, I think, leave an interesting opportunity for those who wish to protest about President Bolsonaro. And now that 20% of the Brazilian population have received their first dose of vaccine, the opposition are feeling more emboldened. At the weekend, we had the first big demonstrations against Bolsonaro in, I think, 16 different Brazilian cities. And remembering the effectiveness of those demonstrations during the Confederations Cup, when Brazil was staging that 8 years ago, it wouldn't surprise me at all if the opposition were to use this Copa America as a focal point for protesting against Jair Bolsonaro, given that it clearly is, to an extent, his competition, in that CONMEBOL personally thanked him for stepping in and opening the doors to his country to save their tournament.
Yeah. This is probably a stupid question, considering it's Bolsonaro. Are fans in at games?
No. And CONMEBOL have really, really wanted to do this. And they were negotiating until not long ago, trying to force 30% of stadium capacity in the host cities. And this was one of the sticking points in negotiations with Argentina, because Argentina kept on saying, no, there's no way that we're going to do it. At the moment, the Brazil's FA, I did a TV thing with their head doctor a couple of weeks back, and they're saying in the current circumstances, you just can't have fans inside the stadium. The players should all have been vaccinated. CONMEBOL, and this is controversial as well, CONMEBOL secured a lot of vaccines from China, specifically to vaccinate everyone involved with their international competitions, both club and country. This is controversial because there's a scarcity of vaccines in South America, and some didn't think that this was a priority. So that the players and those involved, especially on the coaching staffs, are older and more vulnerable, they should all be vaccinated, and there should be strict health protocols. So although there clearly are risks, the main thing I think here is symbolic.
Yes,
it's part of Bolsonaro's open it all. Let's get as much open as we can.
Yes. OK. And I mean, 2000 a day is fairly shocking, and you'll certainly hit the 500,000 mark at that rate. Is it slowing down? Is that 2000? I mean, every time I talk to you, the word from Bolsonaro Brazil is horrific. Is 2000 a day an improvement, albeit a grim one, on where you were?
It is. Yes, it's an improvement of up around 1000. That's because pretty much everyone over 60 who wants to be has been vaccinated, and a lot of people in vulnerable groups, and you see an impact of that. And the vaccination is happening very slowly, too slowly to reach that 70-75% mark in a hurry, which will do a great deal to slow down the spread of the vaccines. And we're having a very interesting parliamentary commission of inquiry going on at the moment, looking at the government's handling of the entire government's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. And the Bolsonaro government is not coming out of this one well at all. So that's an extra, you know, for this to be happening while this commission of inquiry is digging up facts like the government didn't bother responding to offers from Pfizer last year. Brazil could have been the first country in the world to start vaccination. So that makes the Copa America an emotional bomb to throw into the mix.
Mm. And is Bolsonaro pro-vaccine?
An interesting one. And he once said that he was very wary about these vaccines because they might turn you into an alligator. My mum's had two doses so far, and if anyone's going to turn into an alligator, it's her. It certainly hasn't happened to her. He's at times, he's certainly flirted with anti-vax. There have been times when his people have said, because they're all into guns, and they've said our new weapon is vaccination. So now that it's pretty much proved that the only way to achieve the herd immunity that they've been chasing for so long is through mass vaccination, he's not as anti-vaccine as he once appeared to be flirting with.
Okay. Clock slightly against me, but it's worth mentioning Aguero and Messi back together again.
Yeah, and well, they're back together in for Argentina for a while. You know, whether everyone goes to this Copa America, whether there's a players' rebellion, it's something we haven't touched on. There have been some noises coming out of the Uruguay camp, Cavani and Suarez. You know, why are we doing this?
Right.
But first, there's World Cup qualification. And World Cup qualification is serious. Originally, these were going to be the warm-up games for the Copa America. Because we're behind with World Cup qualification, we're now playing one round this week and one round next Tuesday. So that's serious stuff. So Messi and Aguero in harness for that. And I've always thought that Barcelona would chase Aguero as a means of keeping Messi. They've been mates for a long, long time, since they roomed together back in 2005 in Holland in the World Under 20 Cup, forged a really firm friendship. And it's always been a shame that we haven't seen enough of them together, because for Argentina, quite often the end of season tournaments, they've been a little bit jaded. They haven't been at their best. And the possibility now, we don't know for sure if it's going to happen with Messi, but the possibility of seeing them have a kind of late summer together is, I think, a very intriguing one.
Mm. Tim, brilliant as always. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The OTB Podcast Network with Gets at Go. Quick start car insurance that's ready when you are. Sort your policy anytime online at getsetgo.ie.